44321. Stay tuned now for Coast Range Radio.
You're listening to Coast Range Radio. I'm Michael Gaskill. Is the conservation movement being as effective as we can be? That is the central premise, or one of the central premises, in the book Conservation Confidential. And the author of that book is my guest today, Mitch Friedman, founder and executive director of Conservation Northwest, and the author of the aforementioned brand new memoir, Conservation Confidential, A Wild Path to a Less Polarizing and More Effective Activism. Conservation Confidential is a highly engaging story about Mitch's activism journey and a provocative exploration of his philosophies around what effective activism and strategy looks like. I found myself both agreeing and sometimes arguing with those philosophies, which, alongside some great charismatic storytelling, made for a really compelling read. I'm so excited to speak with Mitch today, and I hope you'll let me know what you think of this conversation. The show email is coastrangeradio@gmail.com. Please reach out anytime. Mitch Friedman, welcome to Coast Range Radio.
Thanks so much, Michael. I love that intro, and it's really good to be here.
I'm so excited to speak with you today. I loved learning about your journey and your career, and I also love hearing people that have been in this as long as you talking, really working through their philosophy and what informs your strategy. So before we get into all of that, I'm hoping you could give listeners a brief overview of your book and then start off with a reading of your choice. And of course, let people know where they can find the book.
You bet. The book's available everywhere. The publisher is out of Spokane, Latow Books, but it's on Amazon and elsewhere. There's an audio version that I recorded myself. It's cheap. It's pretty good, and it's on Audible and whatnot. But my purpose here, and I wrote this sucker 2 years ago, right? I always thought maybe I'd write a book after I retired, but you know, work slows down around the holidays, so it was roughly Thanksgiving-ish, and I didn't have much else going on. Like, let's just start writing. So by early January, I had a draft that I shared with my wife and a couple longtime conservation leaders. And really what motivated it was sharing the lessons from my journey. Some publishers who don't publish memoirs consider it a memoir. I didn't intend to write a memoir. I intended to produce a strategy book, a guidance book for activism told through the first person stories by which I learned these lessons. And that's what it is. You know, there's some hard critiques for my own movement. I think we all have to be harsh with our movement. I sure wish I have come to really admire Never Trump Republicans and listen to podcasts like The Bulwark and, we all know that genre. I think we have to be hard on our movements, because we all have to be better and attain better standards. And in conservation, you know, the things we love are threatened. We have to be effective. So it's in that spirit that I offer all of this. And I'd love to start with a little bit of Oregon history.
Yeah, please.
And it's the very opening of the book. "I can't do it. It's too hard," cried out Mokai from the distance, obscured from view by gigantic Douglas fir trees standing between us. It was June of 1985 in the Millennium Grove, among the oldest old-growth forests in all of Oregon, with trees approaching a millennium in age as wide as a basketball hoop is tall and a football field in height. Such forests once blanketed the Northwest, but a century of relentless logging had decimated their extent. The grove stood on National Forest land in the Cascades, an hour drive east of Corvallis. It's where tree sitting was first tried as a tactic to block logging of old growth or ancient forests. That first climb was done by two people just 2 weeks earlier. Now, six of us were to climb up into the canopies of six different trees before loggers returned in the morning. Six trees, six climbers, six different techniques, so we could learn what worked best. The two activists who adapted these techniques were, like me, in their early 20s. They happened to be avid rock climbers. Michael from Wenatchee, Washington, who had a manic giggle to match the frenetic storm in his mind, was going by the arboreal pseudonym Doug Fir. Val, his calmer athletic girlfriend from Western Oregon, went by the more floral rhododendron. I had taken the name Bruce Budworm, a play on Spruce Budworm, a force instep. Lon, a journeyman California hippie with no pseudonym, was supporting me. He had experience in the methods of nonviolent civil disobedience. I was a neophyte. Lon had a barrel chest and long black hair. He also had a big joint in the corner of his mouth as he leaned back, aimed his bow skyward in a pose fitting for Zen in the art of archery, and loosed an arrow. It skied to loop over the branch, even as we heard the futile clanging of Mokai's sledgehammer. As daylight waned, I asked Lon, what if this doesn't work and we don't get up in the trees? It doesn't matter, replied this sage from the 1960s. What matters is that you are getting empowered.
Thank you very much for that. I really appreciate that reading, and that was a great part of the introduction for the book. So with that, you know, your book starts there, and part of your journey starts there. So without going too deep on any of the chapters or episodes, because I do want to circle back to those, take us through from that starting point, through your activist journey from that more confrontational tactic-minded college student young person to the more collaborative-minded director of a major conservation organization that you are today.
Yeah, it's a 40-year journey. 85 to 2025.
Yeah, so just encapsulate that in 30 seconds.
Yeah.
No, sorry.
Yeah, the first 4 years I was an Earth First leader, getting people busted in the trees, on the logging roads. And it was a great outlet for my angst about the fate of the world and the, you know, beautiful nature. In 89, I founded the group I run now, intended to bring a more science-based approach to protecting the ecosystems and species of the Northwest, but still with an aggressive edge and a flair for the radical tactics. And over time, you know, starting probably in the late 90s and early aughts, some deliberately, some by accident, I got exposed to less aggressive tactics. And reflecting backwards at the great successes and surprising to me accomplishments we've had over 40 years, bringing back wolves and wolverines and fishers and lynx, protecting large wild areas, you know, most of the old growth, the roadless areas, protecting habitat corridors, getting wildlife crossings over highways, you know, that add up to a protected regional ecosystem that was beyond my wildest dreams. I look back on the tactics that were most effective and had the least social friction and blowback. And that's the story I tell and the tactics I advocate.
Well, let's talk about some of those examples from the book. I think one of the episodes of the book and your career that encapsulates, at least from reading the book, the philosophies that you're advocating for the best is wolf reintroduction in Washington. I found that section really engaging. You know, you went through some of the highs and low points that you as a person and an organization had and the extreme challenges. So could you talk a bit about wolf reintroduction in Washington and the way that your organization and Washington writ large has approached that, that you think has been more effective in other states?
You bet. And I'll even start a little bit upstream of there.
Mm-hmm.
Because in the forest theater, You know, we were at war with the timber industry over the big trees. And there came a point 20, 25 years ago where accidentally we learned that a lot of the sawmills didn't want the big trees anymore. What they wanted were small trees, which were overabundant, particularly in the dry, you know, fire-driven forest ecosystems. And it presented an opportunity to collaborate. You know, can we change the behavior of the Forest Service by working with allies who had common interests in timber industry? And that's worked really well. And so a few years later, when wolves showed up, you know, we always dreamed of wolves coming back to the Northwest. And then they did. They came on their own, starting around 2008. And it became apparent to us at Conservation Northwest that wolves, unlike, say, spotted owls or fishers, are not a habitat specialist. They don't need a particular threatened habitat. They're generalists. They can live anywhere if they're not being actively shot and trapped and poisoned. So wolf recovery was more a matter of coexistence, of building human tolerance, of reducing conflict. So we at Conservation Northwest invested heavily in range riders and other forms of conflict deterrence to minimize the number of livestock that would get preyed on by wolves and thereby minimize the aggression and hatred towards wolves. And 17 years on, the best comparison is to Oregon. Because in Oregon, there's been a little bit of that, but more it's been a traditional, the activist movement took a more traditional, hostile approach to the agencies and the ranchers. Sue them if they do it wrong, but don't help them do it right. And we've had some rough days in Washington. There were days early on where a pack or two got into trouble, killed a bunch of cattle and had to be killed themselves. And me and my staff, a bunch of wolf lovers, wolf advocates, had to go to the press and publicly bless the killing of wolves as part of an agreement with the ranching industry that we were all going to do better in the future. And this has worked. In Washington, we have the lowest rate of human-caused mortality of wolves and a lower rate of wolf predation on livestock. We have more range riders in Washington than any other state, maybe anywhere else in the world. Oregon, you know, continues the more confrontational approach, and it hasn't served wolves well. There's been more cattle blood, more wolf blood, and just compared side by side, our recovery is doing better. And for me, that's a confirmation of collaborative tactics. If we can help, if we can find common ground with ranchers, with loggers, with developers, and help them solve their problems, and they help us solve our problems, we all win, particularly the wolves.
Yeah, I was really struck by the episode where you all, you know, for very understandable strategic reasons, made that difficult choice that you just referenced of, you know, publicly signing off on agency extermination of an entire pack. And I can imagine, as you say, how hard that must have been for you all. And I can, you know, hear some of our listeners really, you know, taking exception to that. And I would just say this is an example of why I think your book is a great read. Whether you come away from the book agreeing with that decision or not, I appreciate that you really explored the complexities of that.
Thank you.
You talked about, you actually kind of already answered my other question about some of the most difficult and rewarding moments of that ongoing effort. So I want to ask about a couple other key themes, but you know, I'm not in a position to speak to the differences of the Oregon-Washington approach, but to listeners in Oregon, you know, what would your advice be given that, you know, whoever, taking aside blame for where the situation is now, where could people start with a different approach from where we're at here?
Yeah. You know, I really wanted this book to come out before the election last year. Because this book is about avoiding polarization and how that feeds into the national theme of populism and the reaction against elites and liberals and whatnot that I think played a role in sweeping Trump into office. And those culture war issues, you know, gods and guns and gonads are a big part of that, right? Sexual liberty and freedoms. But I think we'd be naive to say that environment isn't also part of it, particularly climate and hot button issues like wolves and old growth. And what if we could find enough common ground with conservative communities to take environment out of those culture wars and cool down the temperature of the country a little bit, have less polarization, less populist backlash? Maybe we wouldn't have this MAGA movement in our face taking all of our rights and making a mess of the world right now. It's tough. You know, again, I wanted the book to come out before the election. Instead, it comes out at a time that we're all triggered. We've been provoked. We're mad. We want to respond. But for all of these issues, now, a year ago, a year from now, forever, we should all be thinking about how we serve the causes we care about. Our actions are not an expression of our angst. They're in service of the wolves, or the transgender people, or of Gazans, or of homeless people, or hungry people. Whatever activist movement you're part of, your job is to serve an outcome. And a lot of times I think activism doesn't serve the best interests of the needy or the wild. Instead, we're aggravating the polarism because we're acting out of anger or fear.
Yeah.
We need to be better than that.
Well, that gets to one of these things that I want to try to get into depth on in a little bit. I will say I'm glad that your book came out after the election because you were able to reference that. And that is the reality we're living in now, you know. So if it had come out before the election, it's possible it wouldn't feel quite as of the moment. So I think it's good, you know, that you were able to at least in that book glancingly acknowledge the reality that we're living in today. And that doesn't, I don't think that makes any of your points less relevant. So before I try to get us into some of these deeper strategy questions, I also wanted to ask about another of the key kind of efforts of your work, which has been landscape level conservation. You know, things like connectivity corridors have been a through line of your work for decades. So could you talk about the importance of landscape level conservation strategies and connectivity corridors?
You bet. And maybe it's helpful to understand landscape conservation by contrasting it with sort of a save it all paradigm. So landscape conservation means protecting core areas where there's sufficient habitat to support self-sustaining populations of a lot of wildlife species, and connecting those together with habitat corridors so those populations can interbreed. And corridors, you know, they're not necessarily wilderness. They can be through working lands, ranches, you know, even timber country. You need ways for the critters to cross the highways. In Washington, we had a real breakthrough on that. On Interstate 90 over Snoqualmie Pass through the Cascades, my organization, it was checkerboard land where in Abe Lincoln's time, Congress gave away alternating square miles of land to subsidize construction of the railroad and right through the Cascades. So that was turning one ecosystem into two, dividing it as those square miles of habitat were being clear-cut logged, plus the interstate running through there. So we had run this big campaign raising, you know, tens of millions, you know, literally 18 million private dollars, over 60 million public dollars to get 45,000 acres of industrial timberland into Forest Service ownership right where these habitat corridors were needed, where we knew wildlife were crossing. So we were creating land bridges, habitat corridors between the North and South Cascades of Washington, right as our Department of Transportation was planning to widen and straighten I-90. So they then put in underpasses and a grand overpass. They're right now building a second wildlife overpass, not just for the big toothy furry critters, but even for the amphibians and the small mammals. Really world-leading stuff. This was 20, 25 years ago and continues today. That's what landscape conservation is. It means protecting enough of the landscape so that nature can survive, maybe thrive, alongside a prosperous human population. So one more critical part of that landscape conservation argument is that wilderness is a great concept for a certain part of the landscape, for the high mountains, for the hot deserts, for the swamps, the places that indigenous peoples, Native Americans, pre-colonial, did not have a major presence. But for 12,000 years, most of the ecosystems of the continent were, you know, if they weren't actively farmed or you know, occupied at significant human densities, they were probably getting burned really actively. Fire was a critical tool to indigenous peoples in forests and in grasslands. It's how people cleared out brush so they could see predators coming. They could create better forage for the ungulates, the deer and elk that they like to hunt and eat, and get the berries to grow back, make it easier to move through the landscape. And, you know, for 100 years, we had the smoky bear mentality. We're cutting the big trees, leaving the little ones, putting out the fires. And this was true not just in forests, but in our grasslands of the Great Plains. Huge impacts to biodiversity and ecosystems that we're now suffering for. So wilderness is a great concept in a certain part of the landscape, but I believe that landscape conservation, with wilderness in the core areas and Elder Leopold's principle of the land ethic, of managing the land for its health, in some places that's very active management, fighting invasive species, restoring damaged, you know, harmed land, reintroducing fire and keeping fire on the land, and having a presence that could be agriculture, could be generating food, all of these things. That's part of the common ground that allows us to not have to be at war between urban and rural communities, you know, fighting for, you know, culture war that overflows into politics.
And it brings us more in line with, I think, most conservationists, you know, stated values of uplifting tribal sovereignty, because like you talked about here and in the book, which I really appreciated, our land for thousands of years doesn't really have much of a history of no-touch management. And, you know, it might look a lot different than it does today, but we have to, it's important that we're starting from that place. So I really appreciated that you brought that into the book, and that seems to really authentically inform the work of you and your organization.
Thank you.
I do want to take the time that we have left. I know you have a hard out coming up. I wanted to ask you about some of the parts of the book that I found myself agreeing with parts and disagreeing with parts that I found a little challenging. So I want to hear, first of all, a bit about you have critiques throughout the book of more radical elements or maybe hardline folks. Like you talk about people who want no cut, right? Who want zero wolf kill. Talk about your critiques of those more radical positions, and then we can go from there.
Sure. You often hear it described as the Overton window, and it's working out really well for the right wing these days.
Mm-hmm.
But in my experience, you know, this was how I was trained as an Earth Firster. David Brower used to say, I started the Sierra Club, and then Friends of the Earth made the Sierra Club look reasonable, and then Earth Island made, you know, Friends of the Earth look reasonable, then Earth First made, you know, everyone look reasonable. Do that, you know, make Earth First look reasonable. In other words, get more and more radical than the last guy. Instead of just saving the old forests and managing better on long rotations and leaving the streams with buffers, never cut any damn trees. You know, that's the zero cut movement on national forests. I don't think it helped at all. I think that leads to cultural war. It provokes a reaction. It's very threatening. There's no common ground when you take an absolutist position. And yeah, it might make somebody look more reasonable, good cop, bad cop, but I haven't seen it play out that way.
Yeah, you know, something I try to do on this show, because I interview a lot of folks that I would say, You know, I actually don't interview many organizations and people working for those organizations who advocate for zero cut at all. I think it would be a more complicated, you know, relationship that folks have, but still veering into that maybe not no compromise, but very little compromise territory. And I try to, you know, respectfully push folks on some of these points. So I found myself really agreeing with a lot of what you were saying. I also found myself a little challenged by, well, at one point you said that confrontational tactics don't serve the cause, and use kind of the hammer analogy of if you're a hammer, everything looks like a nail or whatever the thing is. And I totally agree with that. I also think sometimes there are nails and sometimes you do need a hammer. And so I guess I wonder, especially in this second Trump era, I guess I wonder if you really feel like confrontational tactics are never the answer, or whether it's more of we need to look in our toolbox and actually see which tool or set of tools will solve the problem. And sometimes that is hammers. Sometimes that is, I don't know what kind of tool you want to be a proxy for collaboration, but you get my point.
You're right. You're right. I totally agree. I mean, I throw Ralph Nader under the bus in the book because I think we have a culture of litigation that he initiated in the, you know, in the 50s and 60s. It led to a bunch of groups with a bunch of lawyers that have done a lot of work, and it was needed. Public agencies had become captive to the industries they were supposed to regulate. The Forest Service here in the Northwest was clear-cutting 2 square miles per week of old growth in service to the timber industry. They were capped. We had to kick their ass. Litigation is needed, and we still sue agencies and others at times. But we're the progressives. We're the ones who are supposed to believe in government. It's the other side that wants freedom from regulation and from government. So it's incumbent on us to demonstrate that government can work, not always be demonizing government and undermining it. Some of this is popular these days in Ezra Klein and Derek Thompson's book, Abundance. You hear a lot about that. And I believe that, you know, even, you know, stopping growth into sprawl, stopping sprawl has, you know, limited housing, which has driven up the cost of housing, which has made it impossible for young people to buy homes and increased homelessness. You know, maybe we shouldn't be fighting everything. Maybe we should be finding solutions. So anytime you're in a fight, you know, environmental or otherwise, that a government agency is involved in, yeah, suing's an option, but maybe there's another way to solve the problem that helps that agency succeed, solving the ecological problem and demonstrating that government can be efficient and work.
Well, on that note, your book is Conservation Confidential. I definitely recommend folks go out there and get it. I think that there is a lot to learn, whether you agree with everything in the book or not. I think it's probably better if you don't, because that's what makes a good, you know, cultural conversation within our movement. So, Mitch Friedman, thank you so much for all of your work. I really appreciate it, and I really appreciate your time. Thanks for joining us on Coast Range Radio.
Thank you.
That's all we have time for today on Coast Range Radio. We are an independent volunteer-run show. You can find Coast Range Radio free and ad-free on all podcast apps, and you can follow us on Instagram if you're into that sort of thing. The show email is coastrangeradio@gmail.com. Reach out, let me know what you think of the show. I'd love new guest ideas, or if you're interested in helping with the show as well, I'm always looking for help. Until next time, thank you so much for listening. Let's make it through this together. Thank you.
are tuned in to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
Don't know what to get your loved ones this season? Check out kboo.fm/merch to snag some KBOO swag to support community media in style.